Welcome, everybody, to the Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Each week, Ray spotlights in-depth interviews with legendary and up-and-coming authors and music artists. Ray also features the movers and the shakers of the music and publishing industries and suggests important methods for getting the most out of your public relations and marketing needs. Please welcome music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello, everyone. I'm Ray Shasho, and welcome to the show where we spotlight legendary and up-and-coming music artists and authors. Brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or visit www.publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Our very special guest today is legendary bass player Kenny Aronson. Kenny Aronson was born, bred, and buttered in Brooklyn, New York. He started playing drums at the age of 11, following in his older brother's footsteps. Kenny switched to electric bass at the age 14 after becoming enamored by the low end of the bass on Motown records that he would hear on the jukeboxes in local pizza joints. To this day, he is still a huge James Jamerson fanatic. As a teenager, he played bass for Brooklyn-based hard rock band Dust, which included Mark Bell, a.k.a. Marky Ramone, and released two albums in 1971 and 72 on the Kama Sutra label. In 1973, Aronson joined the New York band Stories, whose single Brother Louie reached number one on the Billboard Cashbox and Record World charts. Kenny Aronson went on to become a recognized world-class rock and roll bassist with his extensive touring and recording with a variety of artists, including Bob Dylan, Billy Idol, Joan Jett, Billy Squire, Foghat, Sammy Hagar, Neil Sean, Kenny Aronson with Michael Shreve, Brian Sutzer, Mick Taylor, Dave Edmonds, Robert Gordon, Graham Parker, Hall & Oates, Edgar Winter, Leslie West Band, Rick Derringer, and the list goes on and on. In 1988, Kenny was named Basses of the Year by Rolling Stone magazine. Aronson was also basses in the house band for the MTV Guitar Greats show, where along with Dave Edmonds, Chuck Leavell, and Michael Shreve, he had the opportunity to back up artists as diverse as Steve Cropper, Brian Setzer, Lita Ford, Tony Iommi, and David Gilmour. A few of Kenny's most memorable moments in his career were auditioning for the Rolling Stones, recording with George Harrison, and opening for Led Zeppelin. Kenny Aronson supports singer-songwriter John Eddy. In the summer of 2011, he toured with the New York Dolls, supporting Motley Crue and Poison in the U.S., along with solo Dolls dates in Australia. In the fall, they toured the U.K., supporting Alice Cooper. Kenny has recently supported Corky Lang, Robert Gordon, and Philadelphia's In the Pocket. Most recently, Kenny is a member of the legendary Yardbirds and Radio Exile, who recently released their debut CD and official video entitled Soulfire. It is my great pleasure to welcome prodigious bassist Kenny Aronson to the Ray Shasho Show. Hello, Kenny.
Hey, how you doing? You know, I'm so impressed with that, I'm going to hire myself.
Well, I guess we're done, right? I think I covered it.
Wow, that was pretty impressive.
Man,
you know, it's funny. Just before you called, I'm sitting here actually working out a baseline of James Jamerson's from a Junior Walker song called Mutiny.
Oh, wow, really?
So that's what I was doing for the last couple of hours.
Pretty cool. You know, it's kind of ironic because my last show featured Marky Ramone, and by the way, he says hello.
Oh, great! Yeah, he never calls me. I just hear it from like doing interviews with people.
Isn't that nuts?
No, you know,
the story of you guys together with Dust is an incredible story. I mean, it'd be a good documentary. Because, you know, you, Marky and Richie Wise played together. I guess Kenny Kerner was the producer, and he wrote a lot of the lyrics.
Yes.
And, you know, Dust toured with, you know, Alice Cooper, John Mayall.
Well,
you're right.
We didn't tour. We just did the occasional isolated gig.
Right.
That would really get us out of the basement where we used to rehearse all the time. So we never toured. It would just be, we played with Alice on a show. We did, you know, we opened up for the Groundhogs down in D.C. actually.
Mm-hmm.
at a place called My Mother's Place. I don't know if you remember that.
I do remember that.
So, you know, it was very limited to actually how much live stuff we did.
But, it's still remarkable because you guys were still very young, you know, and you were you came about in a time where, you know, rock and roll was, you know, hard rock was at its almost its height during, what was it, late 60s, early 70s, right around there, right?
Yeah, I mean, I started playing in Dust in the late 60s. I mean, we didn't do anything until 70, 71 when we finally got a chance. Well, we finally got signed to Buddha Kama Sutra Records, but for years, you know, and Dust was available. Dust existed in other forms. I mean, Dust was around before I got into Dust.
Right.
When I was in junior high school, I used to see people walking around with yellow buttons that said Dust on it, and I had no idea what that was. And then when my parents moved to another neighborhood and I met a whole other bunch of kids my age who were really into playing music, I gravitated to another neighborhood by a subway station in Brooklyn called Parkside Avenue. And that's where I found all these kids my own age that were into playing music. And that's where Dust used to hang out. And eventually, by playing with other people in other bands before, I finally got into Dust. But Dust went through so many variations. We had keyboard players. We had multiple guitar players, all until it filtered down to the trio of Richie, myself, and Mark.
You know, it's a shame you guys kind of disbanded. And what I understand after talking to Marky, the label is run by guys that knew only bubblegum music, right?
That is correct.
Yeah.
It was a total bubblegum label.
And I guess you guys kind of split up because maybe you were impatient, you wanted to do other things, you know, at that point.
No, actually, you know what happened was we did the second record.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing was really happening. Richie Wise was the kind of guy that really didn't want to go on the road. He was very into being with his girlfriend and sort of staying home, and he's married to that same girl that was his junior high school sweetheart.
Really?
Yes, they're married. They've been together forever. He's got kids. He's got grandkids. But I think he was not. Richie wasn't really the type of guy that wanted to go on the road. He wanted to stay home. He was much more into a producing mentality. And when we were breaking up, that's when Neil Bogart was starting to plan the Casablanca record label, or he had put it together, and he gave Richie and Kenny the opportunity to do production work. And so, really, that's how it kind of disbanded.
It's still amazing because, you know, basically you four guys went on to great things, you know, and it was during a time where, you know, things were popping. I mean, you know.
Yeah, those were the days where anything could happen. And, you know, those are the days when you had complete freedom to do whatever the hell you wanted, basically. Mm-hmm. And those are the days when a label would stay behind you for 2, 3, maybe 4 records without just, you know, dumping you because your first record didn't do anything. So goodbye, next.
Yeah.
It wasn't like that. You had support. You know, they stayed with you and tried to, you know, develop it. You know, it was a whole different time.
Well, for our listening audience, the amazing thing, Kenny Koerner went on, like you said, Casablanca Records. He went on, he was instrumental in getting a lot of the Kiss stuff, you know, out there. And Richie Wise he produced, I guess, a few of the Kiss albums in the beginning as well.
Kiss Records, then Gladys Knight Pips. He did a bunch of stuff. Then he went on to do A&R work for Scotty Brother Records, did a lot of stuff out there with them.
Then you went on to the Stories, and you became one of the most sought-out bassists in rock history.
Well, you know, the whole story behind Stories mm-hmm. was that Stories was also on Kama Sutra Records.
Okay.
Stories and Dust had the same manager. His name was Dominic Cecilia, and he managed both bands. And at the time that Dust was breaking up, Stories was also floundering because Michael Brown, who was the creator of that band, he left. So they kind of reshuffled everybody around, and I got into Stories and continued with them, had the number one record with Brother Louie, and that basically started my career as a sideman.
Now, were you in the studio for the original recording of that song?
Absolutely, I'm on that. And also, an interesting story behind that mm-hmm. is that Stories cut that record for another band. I don't know if you're going to remember them or not, but on Kama Sutra Records, there was a band called Exuma, and they were from the Caribbean.
Right.
And Kenny Kerner and Richie Wise were hired to do a record with them and to get it more produced, more polished from what they had done before. And the band Stories, me, the guitar player, Steve Love, the drummer, Brian Madej, we went in there, and our keyboard player, Kenny Bichelle, who, by the way, is a world-class piano player, really very deep cat. We went in there as session players just to do that record for this other band. Mm-hmm. And what happened was, after we cut the track, Ian Lloyd from Stories came in to throw on a scratch vocal so Exuma would know how to sing the song. And when Mule Bogard heard that, he said basically, screw Exuma. This is going to be the next Stories single. And Ian Lloyd did that vocal in one take.
Wow. Wow.
And the next thing we knew, it was us, it was our song, and Neil Bogart promised us, he said, this is going to be number one.
Mm-hmm. He was right.
He was right.
I know Hot Chocolate did that song too, but, you know, it didn't pop.
No, it is written by Hot Chocolate. It is a Hot Chocolate tune, and if you listen, we did the definitive under 3 minutes American, you know, single version of that mm-hmm. song. We cut out all the fat.
And of course, it got revamped again. It's got a new life, you know, with Louie, the show, the TV show.
Yes, yep.
I don't see
a dime from that.
That's a shame.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. I think they built that whole show around the song.
And they used Ian to do the vocal. That's Ian Lloyd singing it again.
It's that Tim again, right?
yeah.
It's amazing after you guys broke up that you never really collaborated, you know, all those years, you know. I think on the last album there was a song that you kind of did together, right, from different locations.
You're talking about the last Stories record?
No, on the Dust album. I went back to Dust. I think when you re-released the last Dust album, wasn't there a track on there that you guys kind of, a new track that you guys did?
No.
Oh, there wasn't a new track. Okay.
No. That's just whatever we had done originally, remastered and, you know, re-released.
Okay. I thought there was a track that you guys were doing together, but at different locations or something like that.
No. Okay. I know. I mean, there's a lot of people that contact me to go, you know, you guys should really do another record. But you know what? We're also all over the place. And Richie really doesn't play guitar much anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's retired, so he doesn't really have any interest in it.
Yeah,
and you know what? To be honest with you, you know the expression, you can never go home again.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
And that's totally true. I mean, to me, it's better to love it for what it was, mm-hmm. for the time, you know, however it means, whatever it means to people that really dig it, it's all good. No point in going back there again.
Right. Well, you've been very busy throughout your career, and very busy again now. I mean, you're a current member of the Yardbirds right now. Are you touring with them again?
Yes, we are about to. I'm going to England with them in a couple of weeks to do a couple of shows. And then starting in the summer, we're doing a West Coast run. We're going to be doing an East Coast run. There's also some stuff already being booked for next year.
Mm-hmm.
It's great. I mean, it's Jim McCarty. The original drummer is still
right
there. And the new lineup is me and Johnny A. from Boston is playing guitar, who's a monster guitar player. And John Iden, who's been in and out of the band now for about 14 years, he plays guitar and sings. And then we have Mike Scavone, who's from a really great band from the Jersey area called the Doughboys,
mm-hmm.
A really cool kind of garage rock band that are great. I always try to see them when they were around. And he's playing harmonica and playing percussion in it as well.
Yeah, I interviewed Jim McCarty way back when. He's a nice guy, really, really nice guy.
Jim's a sweetheart, wonderful guy.
Good guy. What about an album? Are you guys going to do an album together? Or?
Oh, I don't really know. That there hasn't been really any talk about it. I don't really know. I mean, it would be really cool to do some recording, but
right
now we're just concentrating on doing some more touring. And I just emailed Jim and made some suggestions for some other tunes to do this time around, because mm-hmm. if we go back to some of the clubs we've already played, I think we should, you know, mix it up a little bit. There's so many great songs, and there's only so much time you can do it, you know, in one show. So
yeah.
I think we're gonna mix it up a little bit more this year. So that'll be cool.
That'll be great.
Yeah, I'm a huge Yardbirds fan. I mean, the Yardbirds meant so much to me when I was a teenager. It's arguably the reason why I play bass.
Mm-hmm. Great band. Great band.
Great
for
band
all.
And such an amazing legacy of the guitar players that came out of it.
Yep.
And you wouldn't have Led Zeppelin if you didn't have the Yardbirds.
Oh, that's right. Exactly.
You know. So
they kind of morphed into Led Zeppelin, pretty much.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's just incredible, the legacy of that band, you know.
Well, while you're touring with the Yardbirds, now you got also Radio Exile.
So that's another interesting story, because now that kind of goes back. You know, now it's funny, you're talking to me, you know, I've got sort of associations to a certain degree with, you know, and I'm doing the quote-unquote sign here, with classic rock.
Right.
Although, if you really look at what I've done, I have a pretty diverse career in terms of the kind of music and the kind of artists I played with.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, like I did the thing, HSAS, with Sammy Hagar, Neil Sean, and Michael Three.
Right.
And, you know, Derringer, and that whole period in the 70s when you had Foreigner and Boston and Pat Benatar and Peter Frampton and all that stuff, Aerosmith.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all that stuff, those are all the people that Derringer was touring with back in the day. I mean, we were on a lot of the shows that Frampton Comes Alive was recorded, you know. We were there opening up for Peter when that album was being recorded. So, you know, so I have those classic rock associations from the first time around. So anyway, to make a long story short, I'm doing a gig in New Jersey with John Eddy, who's a great singer-songwriter, and I've been with him for a long time. But that's a band that sort of flies under the radar, basically, you know. But he's a really good songwriter, and it's a great little band that we have. And so I'm working with John one night, and I get to the show, and before the show, there's an opening band playing. Now, I didn't see the opening band, but that band had a couple of guys from Radio Exile in it.
Okay.
And after we were talking, we were introduced in the dressing room before I went on with John Eddy, and they seemed like nice guys, and they knew who I was and was interested in what I had done, and they said, look, we're thinking about doing this record at some point. Would you be interested in getting involved with it? And I said, sure, but, you know, a lot of what I do these days is I do a lot of session work. I do a lot of stuff. You know, you have to do a lot of stuff. It's, you know, you have to throw a lot of poop against the wall and see what sticks. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's just the nature of the way it is. And
yep.
And plus, I've always been the kind of person that thrives on doing a variety of different things. I get bored doing one thing all the time.
Right.
So I love too many different kinds of music mm-hmm. to just do one thing. So they seem like really nice guys. They started sending me the material. All the bass lines were done on a synthesizer. And I basically took a hint from that and then kind of did my thing with it. And I ended up going into the studio with them, and we really did it like in two sections. I went in and cut half the record in one day, and then we picked another day, and I learned the rest of the stuff, and we cut the rest of the stuff on another day. They started sending me, you know, finished tracks, and I'm like, damn, this sounds really good. I mean, you know, and it's not the kind of music that I really play very much these days. I haven't played that kind of music in a really long time. It's really kind of a throwback to the old days of real classic rock. I mean,
it does, yeah.
The songs are huge. The guitar playing is
yep.
really ferocious on it. But, you know, vocal-wise, it's got more of that period of approach. And lyrically, it's got a really positive message to it.
Now, the lead singer is Chandler Mogul, right?
Chandler Mogul right. And Dave Anthony on drums.
Right.
And Jimmy Leahy on guitar. And he's a badass guitar player. Mm-hmm. All the guys play great. I mean, Dave, the drummer, is a monster player. I've seen him play with other bands in the Jersey area. He also plays in a Motown kind of party band. And he's also a great jazz player. I mean, they're really, really, really great players.
And Charlie Calve on
keyboard. And Charlie Calve, yeah. man. And Charlie's yeah. a sweetheart, man, and great keyboard player. And it's really Charlie and Chandler's project, actually.
Uh-huh.
So, And the sad thing is, I mean, I don't know, I mean, right now they're just sort of doing some publicity and they've got a couple of videos out, but we were supposed to do a gig together and I just found out that for whatever reason it didn't work out. So I was really looking forward to playing with them and seeing
right.
how it goes. And then, you know, how things are with some issue with the club or the promoter or some
right.
issue with money. It's always, you know, something, but right now, the gig got canceled, but hopefully we're going to try to do something at some point and do some shows.
Well, I can get you a gig down here. I just got Corky Lang a gig. He's going to do some mountain stuff. And I'm kind of friends with some of the guys down here in these venues. This is like near Clearwater and the Tampa area. So,
you know what? You should. I mean, listen. If those guys can put something together, if the cats from Radio Exile can put something together,
okay, I'll help you down here.
And everybody's schedules work out because
yep.
you know everybody's doing what they got to do to make a living.
Exactly.
If it works out, I would certainly be happy
sure.
to play with them. You know.
Yeah, Corky just got booked, and he's happy about it. He'll be there. He'll be in Largo, Florida, in June.
I yeah. love Corky. He's such a character, man.
He's a good guy. Yeah, I'm friends with Corky. Good guy. We meet for lunch every once in a while when he's in Florida.
That's great. Because I have a lot of memories from when I worked with him and Leslie West in 1975.
Right.
So.
Yeah, you're kind of part of Mountain, too, right?
Well, it wasn't Mountain. It was post-Mountain. It was the
okay.
Leslie West band period.
Oh, okay. I remember that. Sure.
So I was in the version of that band
mm-hmm.
with Leslie and Corky, and Mick Jones, pre-Foreigner, was the rhythm guitar player.
That's an incredible band.
Yeah, and then at one point, Leslie and Corky had like a fight,
mm-hmm.
and Leslie quit, and Corky split, and then Leslie got Carmine Appice to play drums.
Right.
So
amazing.
Carmine and, you know, Carmine and Timmy Bogart
yep.
were always heroes of mine when I was a kid because those,
yep.
those were the badass players back in the day.
Right.
So I finally got a chance to play with Carmine, and I got to play with Carmine before I ended up playing with his brother Vinny, which
right.
was after that in Derringer.
Oh, by the way, Rick Derringer lives probably about 15 minutes from me.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Yeah, I know. Rick has been down in Florida for a while. That's correct. Yeah.
Yeah, I think he's talking about moving, though. I think he mentioned Los Angeles or something like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I always thought it strange that he'd be down in Florida, but, you know, whatever.
Yeah. Oh, we got Brian Johnson too. He's got a house here too in Sarasota.
All right. Well, I know a lot of people. Yeah. And there must be something to do with taxes.
Well, that and the weather.
Yeah, and the weather. But I'm thinking money and taxes have got something to do with it.
Probably. I want to go back to Radio Exile real quick, and for our listening audience, the CD's out. You can buy it everywhere, Amazon.com. There's two videos on YouTube that are awesome. One is called Soulfire, very 70s, you know, early 70s rock sound. But my favorite is No Pity on the Highway. That's a great tune, and that's a song that really shows the range of Chandler Mogul as far as, you know, lead vocals. He's got a great voice.
He does have a great voice, and he's a real sweetheart.
It's a very, very good album. I didn't get a chance to listen to the whole thing because nobody sent it to me.
Oh, well, no. The whole album is really good, man. You should check it out. It's really good.
I guarantee everyone's going to love this album. So everyone go out and get it.
There's not a bad song amongst them. So
I got to talk to you about your stint with the New York Dolls, which is really cool. Yeah, I always thought David Johansen was a very interesting guy, you know. What is it like working with David and the New York Dolls?
You know what? I'll be honest with you. David, you know, I know those guys from way back in the day,
right,
when they first started out. And I used to go see them when they used to play this place called the Mercer Arts Center down in Greenwich Village. Now, that building since has collapsed. It no longer exists.
Right.
But I used to go to see them, and these guys would pull women. I mean, the women that would come to doll shows were just unbelievable. I mean, when you grow up in Brooklyn or you're young and you see this, all of a sudden you walk into this scene. I mean, this crazy scene with these guys, the way they dressed back then, the whole sort of glam punk thing.
Yep.
And, you know, they weren't great players. They were really, really raw, really sloppy.
Right.
But the whole scene that existed around them was just so intense. And I can't tell you that I'm real good friends with any of them, but to be honest with you, when I was on the road with them, I didn't really have much to do with David. David stayed by himself. He had his wife with him on the road.
Right.
They basically stayed to themselves. I really got to know Syl a lot better because Syl and I don't know, being that we're Jewish and we grew up in the boroughs and, you know, we have a lot of similar taste in music. I mean, Syl turned me on to some really, really cool stuff while we were on this tour bus for those, you know, bunch of months that we were on the road. But, you know, David is a very intelligent guy. He's actually pretty cerebral.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a really, really wide, very, very wide range taste in music. Because if you ever listen to his radio show on Sirius, he really plays a wide, he's really into blues, very, very into blues, plays great stuff on his show, very eclectic. He's a real character, you know.
Yep.
you know he's done his share of acting, whatever.
Yep.
But I can't tell you, I know the guy very well. And on the road, I didn't really have that much interaction with him as he kind of basically stayed to himself most of the time.
That's interesting.
But it was a bit of a strange tour because, now I'll be honest with you, I'm not really a Motley Crue fan myself.
Right.
They didn't really extend themselves really towards us very much. Nikki Sixx was the one guy in the band that was friendly.
Right.
The rest of them, not so much. The guys in Poison were all pretty nice people. But, you know, we were the opening band. We're touring in the summer, and we're touring this sort of the shed situation, you know, the indoor-outdoor kind of combo thing.
Right.
And it's just weird to go out at 7 o'clock at night while the sun is up to play rock and roll, where everybody is really there to see Motley Crue. So when right. you go on and you're playing in a place that maybe holds 12 to, say, you know, 10 to 15,000 people, whatever it is, and you've got about maybe 4,000 people in, and they're all scattered about.
Mm-hmm.
So you're sort of like playing like, hey, who's out there? There's like nobody here, you know?
Right, right, right.
It's a little weird, you know, and that's what it was like for us, you know.
Now, did you have to be in costume, or did they
no,
do costume?
No, none of that. No,
none
no, everybody, you know, everybody looked fine with the way
right.
they were.
Right.
Everybody just dresses the way they individually dress. There's no,
yep.
no, I couldn't do that. Not at my age, I couldn't do that. No, I don't think so.
So you're not going to replace Gene Simmons when he retires?
No way.
You never know. They may ask you.
No, I don't think so, man. You know, it's funny. A friend of mine named Carl Cochran, who's a brilliant guitar player and who unfortunately just recently had a stroke and he can't really play anymore, but... he was friends with the guy in Kiss, and he, I think, wrote stuff for them back in the day. Well, before he got sick, he took me to a Kiss show when they were playing in New Jersey.
Right.
And we were able to go back and have our pictures taken with the band.
Wow. What year was that?
And, well, those guys know me from back in the day because,
okay.
you know, they're from Queens, I'm from Brooklyn.
Right.
We all started out together. They remember Dust.
Right, right.
And I haven't seen Paul and Gene in years.
Hmm.
And my hair used to really be really long, and it no longer is. And we go back there, and we took these pictures with them, and they were looking at me like, who is this? That, you know, like... They knew they remembered me from somewhere.
Yep.
But Gene in his costume and his boots, and like he was so tall. Like I looked up at him, like he looked like, and his makeup, the makeup was so thick.
Yep.
Like, and I was like looking at him going, geez, it was really kind of bizarre. And then after the show was over, we were hanging around backstage. And Paul came out to say hello, and he said, man, it's really great to see you. I didn't recognize you because your hair's not the same anymore,
mm-hmm.
and it's really been a long time. But it was good to see Paul, and, you know, because we all started, man, we all started at the same time.
Right,
you know?
Right, right.
And we're all from the boroughs, you know, Queens, Brooklyn, whatever.
Yep.
And, you know, we just go back, this goes back so long. You know, it's amazing when you think, like how much time has gone by, and you know these cats from when everybody was just, you know, starting out and just
right.
trying to play music, you know.
Yeah, Marky says I guess when Kiss was in Wicked Lester, they used to watch Dust. They were in the crowd watching Dust.
Yes, I heard
yeah.
that story as well.
Yeah, so you had a lot of bands in the early days, kind of follow you when you were
yeah.
young.
Oh, and then yeah. there was this band from Brooklyn called Sir Lord Baltimore.
Right.
Another band that was around for a while that, you know, did some recording. And I remember I was jealous of them because they actually got to play the Fillmore East and Dust never did, you know.
Right. Right.
Yeah, it's a lot of time gone by, and it's, you know, and every week now somebody that you know or you admire is now dying, you know.
I know. It's so sad. Very
we're at
sad.
That point in life where now
yeah.
that's what we have to deal with all the time, you know. It's kind
yep.
of bizarre, but it's the way it is, you know?
Well, a lot of these guys I've interviewed, you know, and I got them on tape and everything. Like Keith Emerson, just, you know, he just passed away. And
I know. It's crazy, man.
Yeah, and, you know, I followed Ronnie Montrose. You know, we we were at a show in Largo and hanging out with Ronnie, and this is his last show. And at the end of the tour, that was it. He killed himself. You know,
just amazing. And you know, it's weird. Like some people you perceive as being like you know, certain people that we know. You know, they did a lot of partying and this and that. But and you sort of don't know, but you know, it's, you don't. You're not really surprised when you hear certain things.
Right.
But then other people, like, I was really surprised when I heard about Ronnie Montrose, because I never, you know. But you know, it's the weird thing that it's, you know, it happens. You know, and all this stuff. Everybody's getting cancer. Everybody's sick. Like it's like a scourge, man. You know, it's just you realize your mortality at some point when all this stuff starts to happen. It's and it just seems to be really you know, amongst artists/musicians, you know, it's really taken its toll.
Well, it's happening in sports too. A lot of football players are committing suicide. You know, so it's
You know, I mean, I listen. You know, I hate hearing about people that commit suicide, because you've got to be in some really, really desperate place to do that, or in such pain that you can't deal with it anymore, you know. But it just hurts so bad when I hear that.
I know, me too. My best friend committed suicide, and he was I would have never thought in a million years. I used to talk to him every day, and he was an ex-football player, so I don't know if that had anything to do with it or not.
But you know what? I'm glad I'm here. I'm glad I'm alive to talk about it, you know, because a lot of great stuff went down. We saw, you know, our generation, you know, it's funny. I talked to other people about this. Who would have thought that you're a teenager and like the Beatles come along and all of a sudden you could actually do this and make a living at this, playing this rock and roll music.
Yep.
You know, I mean, you could actually make, you know, if you're talent, if you got some talent, and you work at it, and you have a lot of luck on your side, we can make a living at this, which a lot of us have been able to do, you know, at various levels of success.
Mm-hmm.
Some of us have made a lot of money. Some of us haven't. But some of us keep playing and others haven't. So at the end of the day, to me, it all works out even, you know?
Yep.
But, I mean, I don't think that's really a possibility anymore in the same way, if you think about just the way things are. I mean, I don't have children. I know what I put my parents through when I was, you know... My parents thought, like, oh, my God, Kenneth, he wants to play music. What are we going to do? But, you know, when I gave them my gold records to take home that were given to me on the stage at Carnegie Hall with stories, I think at that point they realized, hey, maybe he's going to be okay and things are going to work out, which they did, you know. But, I mean, if I had kids today and they wanted to play music, I mean, I wouldn't discourage them from playing an instrument, but man, if they really wanted to do it as a career, I'd be like, oh boy, you know, because the reality of it today is just not the same.
It's not the same. Nowhere close.
It's nowhere the same. I mean, it just doesn't work the same way, you know.
Right. But back in the day, I mean, there were record companies looking at garage bands, like especially in Michigan, you know. They would go door... Dude, go door to door and sign up all these garage bands because they were hot, they were popular, and they were looking for rock and roll. You know?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, well, my girlfriend is actually she's an Ann Arbor girl, and her brother was really good friends with Bob Seger.
Yep.
So and you know, but you know, listen, you know, I remember back in the early days of going out to play in Detroit. You know, the Midwest was always great rock and roll territory. And one of the shows that I'm going to be doing with the Yardbirds at some point, I forget where it is off the top of my head, but we are doing a show in Michigan, and it's got to do with the honoring or the sort of a memory of the Grand Ballroom in Detroit.
Right.
That was one of those places that had great rock and roll back in the day.
Right, right.
You know, I'm sure Zeppelin played there on their first tour in 69.
Yeah.
You know, it's like one of those special magical places, you know, of a region, mm-hmm. like New York City had the Fillmore East, you know, and the Anderson Theater, which preceded the Fillmore East, where the Yardbirds played the last shows when they were, you know, right before it became Zeppelin. I mean, you know, certain places are just, were magical, you know.
Yeah. Yep, they're shrines, you know.
They're shrines. They're shrines to the real thing, the way that we were lucky enough to be around and be part of.
Exactly. You were...
And it's all disappearing. It's all disappearing.
You were named Bassist of the Year in 1988. What an honor that was, huh, by Rolling Stone?
That was fantastic, considering that I beat out Marcus Miller.
Wow.
Marcus Miller can kick my ass on bass, but I beat him out, man.
That's awesome. And not only that, you also auditioned for the Stones.
I auditioned for the Stones,
yeah.
Yes.
What was that like?
Oh, it was great, man. I mean, I was really nervous. And, you know, but what happened was, at that time, when I found out about it, at that period of time, I actually had a lot of friends from New York that were part of the Stones crew.
Okay.
And they were rehearsing at Studio Instrument Rentals in New York City, which was a big, you know, rehearsal place.
Right.
Because I had a soundstage there that a band like the Stones could go in and, you know, actually work out their show. So what I did was I sent, I gave a friend of mine a letter, sort of a biography about myself, and a short cassette tape of a few things that I've done. I gave it to a friend of mine. He sent it to Mick Jagger. Mick Jagger called me at home, which I almost had a heart attack when that happened. Mick calls me at home, and I was in the shower. My girlfriend at the time says, "Get out of the shower. Mick Jagger's on the phone. He wants to talk to you." So I got out of the shower. I'm sitting on the couch. I'm completely bare-ass naked, talking to Mick Jagger. And he's telling me he's really looking forward to me coming down to audition, you know.
Right.
So I go down to the audition. And at the time, I was playing with Joan Jett.
Right.
So I wear some really nice rock and roll clothing, whatever. And I had this really sharp pink jacket that I had bought in Japan when I was over there with Joan. And so I walked in, and they kind of put me into a side room, sort of like a holding pen, mm-hmm. so to speak. And my roadie friend comes in and goes, "Dude, you got to take that jacket off. Don't go in with that jacket." So I take the jacket off, and underneath I have sort of a sleeveless black Levi, you know, a jean jacket, you know, but
right,
no sleeves.
Right.
So I still look good, but now I don't have my pink jacket, which is fine. I guess they didn't want anybody looking too stonesy. I don't know. It was weird that they would ask me to take the jacket off, but I complied. So, and then after that, Ronnie Wood came in to introduce himself and to sort of welcome me.
Right.
And Ronnie is a really nice cat. I had met him before. And Ronnie also knew Tommy Price from Joan Jett's band.
Right.
So I mentioned, you know, Tommy Price, I work with Tommy, you know Tommy. Anyway, so time for me to go in, and I'm setting up my gear, and they all come in, and I'm looking at them, I'm going, "Oh, man, they're tiny." They're like really small. I mean, Keith was my size. Mick was maybe an inch taller than me. Charlie was little. Ronnie's my size. I mean, it was really strange because these guys are my heroes, and they're so larger than life to me.
Right.
And I'm standing amongst them, and they're all like little guys, you know. So at any rate, at one point, Keith comes up to me. Now, I'm kind of a drinking man. I like my cocktails.
Sure.
But I figured, well, not so much these days, but back then, you know. This was 93.
Right.
So Keith comes up to me and he goes, "I've got a cooler full of Stoli. Would you like a drink?"
Full of Stoli.
And the first time in my life, I turned it down.
You turned it down? Wow.
I couldn't believe I turned the drink down from Keith.
That's why you didn't get the gig.
Well, that's the joke. Because apparently in some book that somebody wrote, I don't know if it was Keith's book, but apparently he talks about some people took the drink and some people didn't. And I couldn't believe that I turned the drink down from Keith,
man.
You know. And it's funny because John Eddy always jokes about that's why you didn't get the gig, because you didn't take the drink, you know.
You didn't take the drink. That's what happened.
The other thing was, now this is really bizarre. I'm standing there and we're playing, and I couldn't hear Charlie because Charlie plays really light.
Uh-huh.
And I'm sort of on the side where Bill Wyman used to be. And Keith is in between me and Charlie.
Mm-hmm.
And Keith has his whole amp rig set up. And I'll tell you, he was loud. And I actually had the balls to ask Keith to turn down
turn
a little
it down.
Bit.
Strike two.
So I'm the guy that asked Keith to turn down. I mean, that's pretty bizarre. And then... And then another funny moment was we were taking a break, and I was talking to Keith, and I said, you know, I just got to tell you, man, that it's really an honor to be here
mm-hmm.
with whatever happens, because, you know, you guys are my heroes, and I just
right.
love you. I love the music, you know, and it's just really an honor for me to be here. And Keith goes in that voice, he goes, "Oh, man, we're just a garage band that got lucky." I mean, we're just a garage band that got lucky. I just thought it was a brilliant remark to say, you know.
That's pretty cool.
And hear that come out of him, you know, with yeah. that voice, you know. It was great, man. I had a great time playing with them. They were really cool. At the end, and at the end of my audition, I'm starting to pack up my guitar, and all of a sudden, Ronnie Wood is on one side of me, and Keith is on the other side, and Mick Jagger is standing in front of me with a Polaroid. He takes a picture, keeps it. Ronnie walks away. He took another picture of me and Keith and gave it to me.
Oh, nice. Very nice.
So at least I have that as a memory.
You still have that?
I still have it.
You got to post it. Did you post it on your website?
It's posted. It's out there.
Okay, I got to find it.
Yeah, you can find it. Yeah, it's great, man. So, you know, it was just a thrill.
What a story.
To play with them. And at one point, Keith or Ronnie said to me that I knew the songs better than they did.
Yeah, I could believe that.
You know, and you know what happened was, because I had friends on the crew,
yep, right.
I had asked one of them, "Is it possible you can get me in here like later instead of earlier?"
Right.
And he said he would try to do that. So every couple of days, my friend would call me and he would tell me what songs they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
So that by the time that they called me down, I knew the whole list of tunes that they were going to do. So I had enough time just to go over them at home and refresh the memory cells, you know, because you know the tunes, but you know, not necessarily, you didn't necessarily ever play the tunes, you know.
Right, I mean,
it's like, how many times are you going to play Stone songs?
Right.
But you know, you've heard them all your life.
Right. Well, what songs did you play during the audition? How many songs did you play?
Oh man, that was probably about 10 or 12.
Really? You played that many?
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
wow.
I played with them for an hour and a half.
Wow. The whole concert.
No, it was great. Some were old. Some were sort of, you know, middle period.
Right.
Some were later, you know. But they were, you know, they were very, they were really very gracious. They were very, very nice. They were very low key. And when they said to me, you know, and they were like forgetting stuff, and they said to me, "Man, you know this stuff better than we do." They were,
yeah.
They were like, "Oh, they're all of them. They were forgetting stuff." You know,
right? That's funny. What a story that is. That's a great story. Imagine if you got the gig. If you got the gig, that would have, you know, that would have been it for your career. I mean, what else can you do after that? Play with McCartney and Ringo and be a third Beatle or something, you know?
That wouldn't be too shabby, but now, you know what? I never expected I was... Listen, those guys auditioned all the best rock bass players in the country.
Right.
They had I mean, all the people they auditioned were people that you would know.
Right.
And then they went to England and they tried people out over there.
Yep.
You know? And I think what happened, I don't know for sure, but this is what I kind of was told.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you remember, but that was the period of time where Keith and Mick were feuding a lot with each other.
Right, right. I remember that.
Yeah. So I think what happened was, because I know who Keith would have wanted, and I know some people that Mick would have wanted.
Okay.
But they weren't going to force each other's people on each other.
Yep.
Which is, I think, why they did the auditions, and they were going to leave it up to Charlie.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about Charlie, he's really, he loves jazz.
True.
You know, he's a big jazz head. And who did they pick? They picked Daryl Jones.
Right, right.
Who's a great bass player, but he has associations with Miles Davis.
That's right.
So it almost kind of makes sense. If you think about it,
amazing story.
You know, but you know, it's like obviously when you see pictures of them, the bass player is never in the photos.
Mm-hmm.
He's not a stone. He's a He's a salaried sideman.
Right, right.
And also, if you look at all the records they've done since then, and since they've had Daryl doesn't play on much of it, from what I can see.
Mm-hmm.
They use different people. They use, like, whoever's around. Keith will play bass. Ronnie plays bass. You know, those guys work on a schedule that if you can't hang out till 4 in the morning to do a track, somebody else will do it. You know
right.
what I mean?
Right.
It really doesn't matter with them. Mm-hmm. That's the way I see them. It's not, you know, the bass is kind of the bass. It doesn't really matter who's playing it.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of could be anybody, because that's the way they've done things for years. I mean, Bill Wyman isn't on every Stones track, you know?
Right.
And it's just the way those guys operate. But
you know, bass is such an important instrument in a song, especially a rock song. You know, I think of, like, Chris Squire, how important he was, James Doer from Robin Trower. You know, I mean, these guys stand out. And you can't, you know, they have their own way of playing bass, you know.
That's true, but you know what? I've always found that the frustrating thing about playing bass, for me, is number one, especially if you're playing large places.
Right.
The bass is the instrument that suffers from bad sound. The first thing that suffers from bad sound is bass guitar.
Mm.
You know, unless you're in a trio or some kind of situation where you're not competing with a lot of other instruments.
Right.
Bass guitar is the instrument that sounds worse once you get out of a club-sized venue.
Right.
And the other thing is, the average person, I'm not talking about musicians. I'm talking the average Joe, you know, the average schmo that goes to a concert. Doesn't even almost understand a lot of times what bass does until it's not there.
Until it's not there, exactly right.
That's the thing. Once it's not there, you realize where's all the low end. Then you go, oh, duh, the bass, you know.
That's a true statement, yeah.
A lot of people don't realize, you know, the average person, they're not, you know, they're there for the song, or for the singer,
right.
You know, they're there for the star of the show. They're not really paying attention to everybody in the band or what they're doing.
Well, you take John Paul Jones out of the equation, Zeppelin's not the same.
You know? John Paul Jones, he's one of my all-time favorites. I love him. He is an amazing, amazing musician. He's just incredible. I love John Paul Jones. Big, big fan.
He's done so much. A lot of people don't know some of the session work he's done. You know,
session
even,
work, yeah. as a string arranger, as an orchestrator. He is a trained, legit musician.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's not some just rock and roll schlub, you know. That guy studied the real way. He went
right.
to school, he studied orchestral, you know, arranging. He's the real deal, man. He's a brilliant keyboard player. I mean, anything he does, he's just good at it. He's the real deal. I love him very much.
Yeah, I don't think he gets his fair, you know, kudos, you know, as with everything that he does. And he's a very quiet guy.
Let me tell you, one of the great live concert experiences that I had mm-hmm. was in the mid-90s, around 96 maybe.
Right.
John Paul Jones had this solo record out called Zuma.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And he did a tour.
I saw him in a small club.
Yes.
Yeah.
I saw him in Irving Plaza in New York City.
Yep.
And he had the drummer and the stick player.
Exactly. Yep.
And John Paul Jones played bass, he played keyboards, he played those giant 10-string lap steels.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And remember he had that three-neck acoustic guitar that he did a looping thing with?
Yep.
Do you remember that?
I remember that.
That show was so amazing. I was like walking a foot above the ground for 3 days after that. I couldn't believe how good it was. And after the show, my friend was his publicist at the time, and she said, "Do you want to meet him?" And I got to meet and hang out with him a little bit. And
awesome.
And he was like my size. He's like a really little dude, you know?
Yeah, I met him as well after the show. I think they had a meet and greet or something like that.
Yeah,
Kenny, I got to wrap it up. We're getting to that time. Kenny, I want to thank you so much, man, for being on the show today.
My pleasure.
For all the incredible music you've given us, you know, all these years, and continue to bring us. You got Yardbird Tour coming up.
Yep.
And Radio Exile, you're part of Radio Exile. That album is out, and you can buy that on Amazon.com. You have, your homepage, KennyAaronson.com, your official website. You got Facebook, www.facebook.com/KennyAaronson. And you're on Twitter.
If anybody needs bass tracks, please get in touch with me. I do session work all the time.
Oh, fantastic. That's great, man. Help the young guys out. You know, they need all the help they can get.
Absolutely. Man, I'm always there to help if I can, man.
And also follow the Yardbirds at www.theyardbirds.com. Watch for the touring. And, Kenny, thank you so much, man. I really appreciate you being here today.
Thank you, Ray. I really appreciate it, brother.
Take care, man.
All right. You too, man.
Join me bi-weekly Mondays at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on The Ray Shasho Show. Very special thanks to Chipster PR and Consulting, Inc. for hooking us up today with Kenny Aaronson, and especially Don and Doug Newsome with BBS Radio for making it all happen every show. Coming up next on The Ray Shasho Show, lead singer and guitarist with the Sheepdogs, Ewan Curry, followed by Ginger Gilmore, author, artist, and ex-wife of Pink Floyd legend David Gilmore, and yes, legendary vocalist John Anderson, who's on tour with the Anderson Ponte Band. If you have comments or suggestions or would like to be a guest on The Ray Shasho Show, call 941-877-1552 or email us at ray@publicityworksagency.com. And don't forget to purchase a copy of my book entitled Check the G's, The True Story of an Eclectic American Family and Their Wacky Family Business, available now at amazon.com. You'll live it. Have a great week, everybody.
Thank you for listening to The Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com. Specializing in author and music artist publicity plans, we shine when we make you shine. Join Ray Shasho every Monday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on BBS Radio, Station 1.